Daily Service, led by John Forrest. Here on FM we begin a new book of the week. Cold Blood by Richard Kerridge is the story of the author's lifelong fascination with some unlikely creatures, a passion that was born of a boyhood desire for close encounters with animals that were truly wild. The reader is Robert Powell.
In the early years of my childhood, I discovered the wildlife of Africa and Asia, as seen in picture books and the tea packet cards I collected, and later on my grandparents' black and white television. Framed in a tiny card, the lion walked in disdainful profile, intent on his business. A tiger's head came up out of the bamboo forest, eyes narrowed. On a sandbank, a crocodile grinned. In Africa, people lived in the same space as these creatures. Britain had no wild animals like this. The nearest to it were the bulls we sometimes saw on our country walks. But if you got close to the ground and saw the forest and savannah down there, Britain did have animals as strange and beautiful and savage as the ones on my tea packet cards. Small faces were there, looking up from the grass and leaf litter. Speckled creatures flared out in sudden colour. There was stalking, there was fighting, there were scurrying dashes for safety. Large, scarred old veterans would glide into sight or bask lazily. Amphibians and reptiles did not live separate, untouchable lives. They were wild and mysterious, yet small enough to be picked up and kept in enclosures where they would not seem domesticated and too big for their surroundings, but would melt into the simulated landscape and stay wild. These animals would not be tamed. They would not nuzzle at their owner's fingers. They lived in my world, but made it seem larger and wilder. Easter holiday, Dartmoor. I crept onto the bridge and peered over. I saw nothing. This was an overcast day and the mud was dark. There were prickles of rain in the air. I was scared it would start and my father would call me away. I jabbed the net under the overhanging grass, making clouds of black mud billow out into the stream. I swooped the net along. In seconds, it was heavy with mud. The weight bending the bamboo stick as I brought the net up onto the bridge and peered in. Something was moving. An insect? Struggling in the weed? No, something shiny and plump. I hooked a finger under and raised the creature out of the slime. Four legs and a little dog-like head. It was a newt, smeared all over with mud. "I've got one!" I called to my father.
"Jolly good."
"I've got one," I gasped in delight to myself. With the net in one hand held over the bridge, I managed to reach down with the other and half fill the jar with water. Gently, between thumb and finger, I picked up the glistening newt and placed it on my palm. At the tip of the tail, what looked like a tiny hair dragged across my wet skin. I dropped the newt into the jar, where, instantly washed clean, it was dazed for a moment, then dived and darted like a fish trying to burrow into the glass. I held up the jar. In the clean water with no dark background, the colours were different, more greeny brown and minnow-like. The underside was white. On the belly was an oval of pale yellow. There was a fish-like semi-transparency. Pinkish shapes moved in the white throat. Down the white underside of an arm ran a thread, a pink vein. The back feet, much larger than the front and thickly webbed, seemed suffused with black ink. Behind them the tail was larger than the body. It was orange, marked with two lines of black blotches. At the end was a tiny black hair. My father inspected the jar in silence.
"Do you want it, Rich?" he asked after a moment. "Do you really want to take it back to London?"
I had no doubt at all. A further half-hour's trawl under the rooty banks yielded one more newt, slightly smaller than the first. In a glow, I walked back to the car, full of plans for my zoo. The two newts were put in a large tin milk can supplied by Mrs. Rose, who ran the farmhouse bed and breakfast where we were staying. I had filled it to about 6 inches deep with stream water. I knew they sometimes needed to come out on land, so I put in a tangle of weed rising above the water and a snapped-off twig with several branches, which gave the appearance of a sunken tree in a swamp, perhaps in the Everglades or Congo. In the muddy swirl, a gold-streaked head appeared, gulped, and vanished. And I was thrilled again. Also staying at the farm that week was a girl of about my age. Her name was Isabel. On the first day, our families had made gruff introductions. At the dining table that night, she was reading one of the Narnia books. I was reading one of my war comics. Isabel had a voice that I knew was posh, but I couldn't tell how posh. I associated that kind of voice with large houses behind tall hedges, neat school uniforms, black Labradors, and schools that looked like stately homes. But also with a lot of the books I enjoyed. School stories and the Narnia books themselves.
Mrs. Rose says you've been catching newts.
I've got two palmates, I said. Palmate newts.
Can I see them?
Yes, I said. Okay. Isabel knelt on a stool to look in. I pointed out the newts to her, one under the twig and the other half under the weed.
Oh, yes, she said.
Then the twig newt came up for air, with a flash of the gold on its head and of yellow as it shimmied back down. Isabel gasped with delight, really gasped.
Oh, it's beautiful. A little dragon.
You actually like them?
I know I seem a prig, she said abruptly. That's what people think.
Oh, no, I said, surprised by that word more than anything else. It was a word out of books, a word from Narnia. I'd never heard a real person say it. No, you don't.
I'm sure I do,
she said.
Oh, it's moving.
The newt was climbing through the branches of the twig, using its hands for leverage. It came to settle with its nose, just breaking the surface of the water. The halves of its bronze eye glittered, separated by the horizontal bar.
They're wonderful,
Isabel said.
Little spirits of the river.
I explained that they were found in ponds and streams, not rivers, but her words made me proud. And we went into breakfast chatting about the nets I had used, how hard it was to tell palmate females from smooth, and the landscape I would create for the newts. She seemed interested. About newts, there are some strange traditional stories. The Victorian writer of popular natural history, the Reverend J.G. Wood, relates in Common Objects of the Country, 1858, that English farmers used to swear that newts had bitten and poisoned their cattle. According to one story, a little girl filling a pitcher at a stream was bitten by an effet that leapt from the water. The creature then spat fire into her wound. Her arm instantly swelled to the shoulder, and the doctor was obliged to cut it off. It's easy to see how these stories might have arisen before antibiotics and infection from foul water could be deadly. Isabel gave me a wave in the lobby and said she hoped the newts would be all right. We drove to London with the can on the car floor, sloshing. Somehow, they survived. I carried the can through the house to the conservatory and next morning set about building their new home. What I wanted was a fish tank, but for the time being all I had was a tall glass jar from the sweet shop, the kind they still use for boiled sweets. I knew that they would change after the breeding season, losing their breeding colours and climbing out of the water to live on land. There was no knowing when this would happen. So I placed a rock from our rockery into the jar and poured in only so much water, leaving a third of the rock exposed. Emerging from the water, it was like the rock in the polar bear enclosure at London Zoo. At the bottom of the jar was aquarium gravel. Blanket weed hung in the water. I dropped in small earthworms for food. Tomorrow, my friends would come and see. They came. And what they saw, what I saw when I ran down in the morning, were two very different creatures from the gold ones in the stream. Gone were the green markings, gold stripes and high, crinkly tails with threads at the tip. Here was a small, neat animal, all one colour, though a beautiful, delicate colour, with very faint marbling when I looked closer. Overnight, they had changed from aquatic to terrestrial form. Their breeding season was over. Had the journey shocked their systems? Perhaps I was right in this idea. These dramatic changes of colour, body shape and texture happen because hormones come and go. In adults and tadpoles, the hormones are responsive to nourishment, temperature, chemical signals in water and air, and seasonal cycles, including hibernation. I missed my golden, flashing creatures, but I also liked the change. The two newts on the rock were more visible, more like animals at the zoo. They were living, miniature dinosaurs. And once I had a tank, I could give them a landscape of ferns and rocky outcrops. What would they eat, though? One of the books had said raw meat, so I dropped a red sliver on the rock. The meat was there untouched when I went to bed. Tiny insects had to be the answer. Greenfly, perhaps. I needed to get the tank soon. But that didn't happen. In the morning, the jar was empty. The newts had got out. I fished out the weed and then the stone. Where were they? The jar was on a work surface in the conservatory, where the floor was made of terracotta tiles. There was a straw carpet. I saw something, looked away, and looked again. On a tile between the carpet and the curtain was the skeleton of a newt. Tears pricked at my eyes. What had happened? I was down on my knees beside the little huddle of bones and found they were not bones, not exactly. The newt had shriveled. It had become a dried-out corpse. They have permeable skins. Under the microscope, their covering is more like netting and binding, holding their organs together, than skin. Amphibians also have surface capillaries, tiny blood vessels whose linings are only a single cell layer thick. This means that oxygen from outside can pass into the blood through the skin, and carbon dioxide from the blood can be released. Amphibians breathe with their skins as well as their lungs. The skin is also permeable by water, which means that they need to remain in at least damp surroundings or their moisture will quickly be lost. This is what had happened. I had made the most elementary mistake of assuming they wouldn't be able to climb sheer glass, and certainly not climb upside down as the glass curved into the narrow neck of the jar. So I hadn't covered the jar. I was wrong. When newts change into terrestrial form, their urge is to leave the water. Their bodies have considerable suction. My fingers held the bony, rigid creature, and for a moment I had the idea that in water, its flesh would fill out and come alive. Instead, I put it into a matchbox, on a bed of cotton wool, like a jewel in a case, and buried it in the garden.
Robert Powell was reading from Cold Blood by Richard Kerridge. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Woman's Hour today comes from Edinburgh. Jane Garvey visits the Anne Rowling Regenerative Neurology Clinic at Edinburgh University to find out about the strong links being forged between patient care and research. And she talks to the composer Sally Beamish about how Scotland has inspired her music. Woman's Hour follows in a couple of minutes.
The Australian High Court judge Michael Kirby talks about the effects of chairing an inquiry into human rights abuses in North Korea.
I have to admit to you, I thought I was a pretty tough old nut, but on three occasions I just wept.
A new series of conversations with some of the world's most influential lawyers.
That's what human rights is fundamentally about, love for one another.
A Law Unto Themselves starts tomorrow morning at 9 on BBC Radio 4.